This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, April 26, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, President Obama addresses Planned Parenthood as reproductive rights advocates call for a bill to protect the rights of Peace Corps volunteers. Lawmakers in North Dakota pass a bill to reduce gas flaring in the state, but residents say it doesn't go far enough to protect public health and the environment. And we'll go to India, where one community is making strides to provide toilets to all residents. It's an issue not only of public health, but of safety for women. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. The White House says they are getting intelligence assessments, quote, with varying degrees of confidence that the Syrian government has used small-scale chemical weapons against opposition militants. Chemical weapon use by the Syrian government is one of the Obama administration's so-called red lines in which U.S. response to the conflict could change. But the White House says the intelligence assessments are building blocks and not alone sufficient to make final judgment of the situation.
The president wants the facts. And I'm not going to set a timeline because the facts need to be what drives this investigation, not a deadline.
Today, when pressed by a reporter, White House spokesperson Jay Carney went on to say that the president is considering options.
He retains all options to respond to that.
Including military force, including military strikes.
All options. All options.
The U.S. says it's investigating at least two alleged incidents of chemical weapon use. The U.N. is also conducting an investigation, but has not been allowed into Syria. The family of a woman allegedly sexually assaulted by a pilot in the U.S. Air Force is protesting after the initial conviction was overturned and the suspect transferred to a base near their homes. Lieutenant Colonel James Wilkerson has now been reassigned to a post near Tucson. Wilkerson was convicted of sexual assault last November, but then a commanding officer threw the jury's ruling out. Earlier this week, the victim advocacy group Protect Our Defenders sent an open letter to Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel demanding that the senior officer who overturned the conviction be dismissed from the Air Force. A new report by the National Wildlife Federation says pollution caused by hard rock mining has disproportionately harmed Native American tribes in the U.S., contaminating fish and other native wildlife that are a major part of Native American culture. Chuck Brumlev with the Keweenaw Bay Indian Community on the Upper Peninsula of Michigan says loopholes in the Clean Water Act allow Michigan to set its own rules on environmental mining standards. He says acid commonly used to dissolve minerals in the rock pose major problems when it leaches out of mine dumps.
The state only requires 5 years of follow-up water treatment, and yet we know from experience that acid mine drainage frequently doesn't even start for 50 years. This creates a source of contaminants to Lake Superior for generations to come.
The Wildlife Federation report calls on President Obama to close loopholes that allow mining operations to dump waste directly into wetlands, streams, and lakes. Tension continues after the April 14th election in Venezuela. Opposition leader Enrique Capriles has vowed to challenge the vote in court after pulling out of an election audit he initially agreed to honor. FSRN's Irina Caselli has the latest from Caracas.
Last week, Enrique Capriles agreed to a full audit of the election, as proposed by the National Electoral Council. But on Thursday, he said the proposed conditions for the audit were unfair. The opposition is due to take evidence of irregularities to the Supreme Court and ask for the election to be annulled, despite the findings of international monitors, which widely indicated the vote was fair and transparent. At the same time, the National Assembly has created a special commission to investigate violent post-election protests that left 9 dead and 78 injured. The government blames the opposition and right-wing youth groups for the violence. On Thursday, Venezuelan authorities announced the arrest of U.S. filmmaker Timothy Tracy. The government charges that Tracy was working with the U.S. to finance the right-wing groups. But relatives and colleagues told the Associated Press Tracy was in the country working on a documentary about the political divide. Irene Caselli, FSRN, Caracas.
This week, Armenians from around the world have been commemorating the genocide of an estimated 1.5 million people by the Ottoman Empire. That empire is now Turkey, and the government there has refused to use the word genocide to describe what happened at the end of World War I. FSRN's Roberto Nieto reports from France, where activists gathered to mark the anniversary.
Armenians around the world are still asking for restitution of land that was taken from their ancestors. An estimated 1,500 people marched through the streets of Marseille Wednesday, chanting and shouting slogans against the Turkish government. One Armenian woman visiting France from Turkey held a sign saying, "Turkey kills, Turkey denies, Turkey continues." Today, they continue repressing and killing intellectuals who speak out, she says, referring to the 2007 murder of an Armenian Turkish journalist for his stance on the genocide. Other marchers criticized the U.S. for supporting Turkey and refusing to use the term genocide. More than 20 nations, including France, recognize the genocide, and there have been some signs recently that Turkey is softening its stance. This week, the French paper Libération reported that small gatherings on the issue had been tolerated by authorities in Istanbul and other Turkish cities. Roberto Nieto, FSRN, Marseille.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Washington today, President Barack Obama became the first sitting president to address the Planned Parenthood Federation's annual conference, telling the organization he will continue to support a woman's right to choose and get access to affordable reproductive care across the country. But some federal workers don't have equal access to these rights, namely thousands of Peace Corps volunteers around the world. A bill introduced this week seeks to change that, expanding their health insurance to cover abortion care in cases of incest, life endangerment, or rape. Reproductive rights advocates are pushing for the bill's passage and say the Peace Corps still has a long way to go toward preventing sexual assault in the program and providing survivors with support. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Speaking to the nation's largest women's health organization Friday morning, the president highlighted advances in reproductive rights over the past several decades, but warned of current orchestrated efforts to, quote, turn back the clock.
In North Dakota, they just passed a law that outlaws your right to choose starting as early as 6 weeks, even if a woman's raped. A woman may not even know that she's pregnant at 6 weeks.
President Obama said that no politician should be able to decide what's best for a woman's health. Yet a law passed by politicians more than 30 years ago continues to dictate the reproductive choices of volunteers in the Peace Corps who get their health insurance through the State Department. Under a policy that dates back to the 1970s, Peace Corps volunteers seeking abortions must pay for the procedure out of pocket, even if they become pregnant from rape or incest, or have a life-threatening pregnancy. Most other federal workers, including Peace Corps staff members, would get an abortion paid for by their insurance under these circumstances. Sharon Levin with the National Women's Law Center told FSRN this is manifestly unfair, especially because of what Peace Corps volunteers often face: isolation, language and cultural differences, and a prevalence of sexual assault. They can also have difficulty accessing contraception in some host countries, increasing their risk of an unwanted pregnancy.
Often, they are far from where they can get legal services, and if they are not able to have coverage, it means that the increased costs they might bear because they have to travel somewhere where abortion is safe and legal, the lack of coverage compounds the kind of financial barriers they might face in getting the services they need.
On Thursday, a group of senators introduced the Peace Corps Equity Act, which would give volunteers the same health coverage as other federal employees, covering abortion in instances of rape, incest, or when a woman's life is in danger. A Peace Corps Inspector General report last year counted more than 1,000 reported instances of sexual assault between 2001 and 2010. But cited the findings of an anonymous survey that found that more than 65% of rape survivors didn't report their attack. Several Peace Corps rape survivors came to Capitol Hill in 2011 to demand Congress address the prevalence of sexual assault in the program, the barriers to reporting attacks, and the State Department's mishandling of their cases. Karistan Konin, who was stationed in Niger in 1991, said Peace Corps staff told her team not to tell their families about a fellow volunteer's recent rape. Not long after, Konin herself was raped.
I was then sent to speak with a Peace Corps staff investigator who said, "I am so sick of you girls going over there drinking, dancing, and flirting, and then if a guy comes on to you, you say you've been raped." My final straw was when my Peace Corps country director said to me, when I wanted to prosecute, "It's your word against his. He said you wanted to have sex, and we believe him."
In the months following this hearing, Congress took up and passed the Volunteer Protection Act, which demands the Peace Corps make sweeping reforms to the way it trains its volunteers, staff members, doctors, and directors to prevent and respond to rape and sexual assault. The Peace Corps then partnered with the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network to begin implementing these improvements. But last year's Inspector General report found that many country directors and medical officers have not been attending the new trainings. The Peace Corps must report to Congress again this year on their progress with the reforms. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
This week, a federal appeals court ruled that the EPA did have the right to halt a mountaintop removal mining project in West Virginia. Mingo Logan, a subsidiary of Arch Coal, had challenged the EPA's veto of a permit for the Spruce Mine authorized by the Army Corps of Engineers. The Clean Water Act permit would have allowed the company to dump mountaintop removal waste into streams and tributaries. Environmentalists celebrated the unanimous decision. John Devine is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
The court said clearly and reaffirmed what the law says clearly, that EPA can act.
Another ruling earlier this week by another federal appeals court found that the Army Corps used an arbitrary and capricious process for giving mining companies permits without assessing environmental impacts. Environmental groups said they've been fighting against what's called Nationwide Permit 21 for 8 years. It gave mining companies the authority to dump mountaintop removal mining debris into streams and rivers. Many residents have also been fighting for cleaner communities. Ginger Dance is from Fayetteville, West Virginia. She spoke to reporters this week following the release of a report on the impact of mountaintop removal mining on human health.
As a mother, I have worried about this issue for years. I have a 7-year-old, and of particular concern to me are the indications that birth defects are at a higher rate in these counties. I live in a mountaintop removal mining county, and it's getting closer and closer. We can hear and feel the blasts from my daughter's school every day. If I can feel and hear those, I'm sure that something else is happening, coming, blowing in the wind, what's happening with the air, what's happening with the water. There are so many unanswered questions.
The Center for Health, Environment, and Justice report found much higher rates of birth defects, cancer, and dying of cancer in communities near mountaintop removal sites. The report was reviewed by the National Commission on the Health Impacts of Mountaintop Removal Mining, which said the evidence shows that mountaintop removal threatens public health and the environment, and called for a moratorium on the practice. Mickey McCoy lives in Inez, Kentucky, where communities are also dealing with the consequences of mountaintop removal mining. He said nearly 30% of total land area in Martin County has been leveled by strip mining and mountaintop removal.
According to the Center for Disease Control, my county leads the state of Kentucky in bladder cancer cases. And everybody, it seems, knows at least one or two people who have lost a kidney to cancer. In my county. My county is part of the Central Appalachians, an area where the number of total cancer deaths per capita is one of the highest in this nation.
McCoy was formerly the mayor of Inez, a town that experienced a massive coal waste spill in 2000. More than 300 million gallons of toxic sludge from Massey Energy's coal operations poured into rivers, creeks, and yards. Residents of Central Appalachia, as well as public health and environmental advocates, are hoping for more support for the Appalachian Community Health Emergency Act, or H.R. 526, reintroduced in February. It would put a moratorium on all new mountaintop removal mining permits and require a comprehensive federal study on the health impacts of the practice. In North Dakota, oil and gas development continues at a rapid pace, setting new records for daily production in the month of February, according to records from the state's Mineral Resources, Oil, and Gas Division. One aspect of the boom has been the increasing practice of gas flaring. That's the controlled burning of excess natural gas. In 1999, the state flared 3% of gas production. Today, that number exceeds 30%. Environmentalists and local residents say flaring presents risks to public health, the environment, and wildlife. This week, state lawmakers passed a Republican-backed measure, House Bill 1134, that aims to cut back on flaring through offering tax breaks to companies, but it's being criticized for not going far enough. For more, we're joined by Candy Mossett. She's from the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation, where her community has seen rapid changes due to the oil and gas boom. She's also with the Indigenous Environmental Network. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me on today.
Let's start with the bill this week. The part of it aimed at reducing gas flaring works by giving incentives or tax exemptions for materials that companies use. In other words, this would still be voluntary. Your assessment of this bill?
Well, first of all, I just want to put out the information around flaring in North Dakota and why it's happening. Basically, the pipeline infrastructure doesn't exist, and the natural gas prices are so low that the oil companies are not interested in gathering the natural gas. It's a byproduct in our state. And what the measure does is it basically just allows tax exemptions for natural gas if it's used for farm fertilizer, electric generation, stuff in the rail line, the railroad line. There was a few other things. And so basically, companies are allowed to get a waiver for the first year that they're in production and allowed to flare. And then they can get another waiver to extend that. And they've already been doing this since 2006.
Is flaring taking place at the Fort Berthold Reservation, at the wells there?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, it's everywhere. It looks like a war zone at night when you go there. You can tell where every single rig is because pretty much every single rig has a flare next to it.
And what does it look like? Describe it.
The thing about flaring is that the higher it is off the ground, the better it's supposed to be for your environment. If you go onto the reservation, those flares are coming directly out of the ground. They're not on a stack. They're not on a pipe. They're in a hole dug in the ground, and the gas or this flame is just coming right out of the earth, and they're huge. And what the companies try to do is build up berms around them, and they try to build up hills around them. They try to hide them from the people that are like on the highways and the roads. But so during the day, it's a little deceiving, but at night you can stand up on a hill on the reservation. Like, we have a place called Crowflies High. You can stand up there, or you can stand up on the Sanish area. They're located right by Lake Skakuya. You can see flares all the way 360 degrees when you turn around. And I'm telling you, from growing up there, it looks like a war zone. You can see everything everywhere.
Beyond what it looks like, how else has it changed people's daily lives or the area? What other effects have there been from flaring?
It's hard to describe unless you're actually standing there and mm-hmm. you know what it used to look like out on the prairie and the Badlands and the plains. It used to be really beautiful and peaceful. There used to be lots of animals and stuff around. But now, because of the flaring and the truck traffic, even the animals are disappearing. Everybody knows it. The hunters that go out, they talk about, man, you can't find anything out here anymore. And it's finally sinking into a lot of people that how much we're being affected by all of this oil industry.
Well, one argument for expanding oil and gas development comes from business leaders. It also comes from federal officials, state and local officials, and they cite that it can promote jobs and economic growth. They often point to a low statewide unemployment in North Dakota, around 3%. Are you seeing the benefits in your community?
Absolutely not. And anybody can go on the statistics in the records for North Dakota employment. They can go all the way back to the 1990s, and they can see an average employment rate in North Dakota, unemployment rate of 3 to 4%. Since before this oil boom ever occurred, 3 to 4% unemployment. And those are the big things that have come out in the headlines in the past 2 years is, oh, North Dakota's unemployment rate is 3%, and it's because of the oil boom, and it's ridiculous. Anybody can look at the statistics and see that it hasn't changed because of the oil boom. It's always been that low. And what we're seeing in our state is an influx, an increase of people from all over the place, all over the country, for one thing, and in some cases from other countries. There's over 13,000 people that have moved in since 2011, and none of them are permanent residents. They're only here for the job. They're only here for the boom. When the boom goes away, they're going to go away. In the meantime, the residents that have lived here for years and years and years are being forced out because we can't afford to keep up with everything that's happening, either pollution-wise, social-wise, all of the craziness and madness that's happening because of all these people coming in, these transients that are living here, or we can't afford to pay our rent anymore. And so if you look at the statistics, regardless of what the federal officials will tell you, that 3 to 4% unemployment rate has always been that way, and the jobs aren't going to North Dakotans. They're going to outside people that are moving in temporarily, and they're going to be gone when the bust comes.
That's Candy Mossett. She's from the Fort Berthold Indian Reservation in North Dakota. It's a site of change in the state's rapid oil and gas boom. She also works with the Indigenous Environmental Network. You're listening to FSRN. Of the world's estimated 7 billion people, 2.5 billion of them lack access to proper sanitation, according to the United Nations, and more than 1 billion defecate in the open. The problem creates unsanitary conditions and life-threatening diseases, and it also affects the safety of women who are targeted when alone outdoors. India is one country that faces these challenges, but as FSRN's Jasvinder Segal reports, one village is making progress and is on track to have toilets for all its inhabitants.
Gopal Kumar is cleaning a recently constructed toilet for his 85-year-old mother, Rampoli Devi, who is blind. He says he's happy to have a toilet in the house so his mother no longer has to bear the adverse impacts that open defecation has on her health and dignity.
The availability of toilets in the home has helped all, especially women, children, and the elderly. Before, the unavailability of toilets was a big problem. The men could ease themselves anywhere, but the women had to face the brunt of the problem. Our village head has helped us with the financial assistance to build toilets.
A toilet within the house is like a distant dream for Gopal Kumar and the 900-odd families living in the village of Soda, which is 40 miles from the capital city of Jaipur in the Indian western state of Rajasthan. As per the last Indian census, half of the country lacks indoor toilets and defecates outside, as does the natives of the village Soda.
What usually happens is that a woman only goes out to ease herself under the shelter of darkness, which is usually prior to sunrise and post sunset. And in the process, in areas where you do not have electricity, they often fall prey to a lot of accidents.
Chavi Rajavat is the elected head of the village. She says the lack of indoor toilets leads to serious health problems.
But they fall in ditches, etc. And I can actually show you photographs of women who have fractured their arms and legs. And these are stories you don't hear of. In addition to which, there is the fear of snakes and monitor lizards, which are out there in the open fields. And on top of that, because they have to wait such long hours to step out in the open, they face a lot of health issues, a lot of gynec problems, which the doctors are not there to attend to. They're always in constant complaining of headaches, of stomach aches, of gastric problems, and so on and so forth. What is even worse is that when they're out to ease themselves, and while they're in the midst of it, if somebody passes by, irrespective of what stage they may be at, they have to stand up instantly.
With the help of an NGO, Rajavat is working to construct a toilet in every house of the village.
It is not that these people do not want toilets, they definitely do. But the sad part is that for them the priority is food in the stomach of the family members. And because they don't have, and because they suffer the pains of poverty, I think even though they want these toilets, more often than not, they're not able to contribute towards it.
One of the first villagers to get an indoor toilet was Chan Sharma. He says that half of the support came from the village council, while the other half came from her mother's saving.
Although it was tough for my mother to arrange even half of the money, the comfort we have now is tremendous.
Chan's father, Ram Kishore Sharma, says it was also not easy to using a toilet because many villagers consider it taboo to use indoor facilities.
Actually, due to cutting of forests, covered areas are not left for defecating in open. But when I noticed that the women of my house are covering their faces out of shame while going out for open defecation, I immediately decided to construct the first toilet in this ward of the village. Moreover, defecating in open is against the pride of women and may act as a catalyst for sexual assault.
Due to India's shortage of water, the village is constructing dry toilets. These kinds of toilets do not have an automatic flush system. Instead, flushing is done manually by limited water. Pragya Chaitanya is the NGO which is helping the villagers with the technique of constructing them. Bhaskar Sharma represents the NGO.
To date, we have constructed 200 toilets, while the remaining will be constructed within the next 2 to 3 months. Thereafter, every house of this village will have the facility of a toilet.
But the government is only helping the poorest and most marginalized people. Others are getting help from the village council, which is providing the materials required for the toilets. Shoji Gujar and his wife Asha Gujar are among them. Shoji's mother Moti Devi is eagerly waiting for the toilet to be completed. Due to arthritis and senility, she walks with great difficulty.
I will benefit the most in the family with the completion of this toilet. In spite of my health conditions, I am forced to travel more than a mile to ease myself. It takes me almost an hour to reach there.
According to the Indian government, one in every 10 deaths in the country is linked to poor sanitation and hygiene. Officials want to improve these numbers and have designed a countrywide campaign to eliminate open defecation by the year 2022. Advocates say while India is making progress, it has a long way to go before it reaches that goal. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSRN, Soda Village, India.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org. And follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.